Today's program is brought to you by Michter's Distillery. Visit michters.com to find out how their taste is everything, cost be damned attitude is creating some of the finest whiskeys available.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and In the Drink comes to you live from Roberta's here in Bushwick, New York, Bushwick, Brooklyn. We actually air live at 10 a.m. on Wednesdays, but you can listen to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org or iTunes. We have all of our episodes in the past archived. Really excited and a unique show for you today. We have a special guest, Nikki Ganong. And Nikki has written a book that is actually released this month, a brand new book, all about the various liquor laws all across America and the complexities and intricacies and unique and quirky aspects of all of these different laws. The book is called The Field Guide to Drinking in America, A Traveler's Handbook to State Liquor Laws. Nikki, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
What an interesting way to approach drinking and also travel. It's something that I think a lot of us maybe don't necessarily think about. What got you interested in this topic?
Well, I'm from a control state, and so is my publisher, and we currently live in one. And so when I say a control state, I mean that the government controls aspects of selling liquor, like distribution and physical selling of liquor and the distribution of it. Yes. So we came up with the idea because we both travel a lot, and I often travel to as a drinking destination. For example, we'll go to the GABF, the Great American Beer Festival in Denver, which pours more than 2,000 beers out of their convention center. But when you go to the grocery store in Colorado, you can only buy beer that's of a very low percentage. So any of the craft beers that they pour at the festival can't be sold in a supermarket. It has to be sold at a specialty store. So that story, along with so many others that we encountered on the road, led to the idea of the field guide.
Yep. And I have to say, the field guide is really great. You make a topic that seems pretty mundane. I mean, I can only imagine reading through all of these arcane liquor laws that were written maybe 90 years ago, a lot of them, actually kind of fun and vibrant and interesting. And I think the graphics in your book are absolutely fantastic. So congratulations on that.
Thanks very much. The cover design, well, we're on radio, so you can't see it, but the cover design and all of the internal illustrations were done by a Portland artist and author. His name is Cole Gerst, and I think he did a great job, too. It's really, it's very catchy, and it's very pick-upable, I guess you could say.
I couldn't agree more. And now, tell us a little bit about how long it took you to accomplish this, and how long did the research take, and how did you actually go about doing the research? Were you able to find all the information online? Did you have to actually travel to the states?
Yes. Well, there are different parts of the book, as you know, through reading it. There's one page that's just the brass tacks, everything that you need to know in one handy info chart. And then there's an essay by me talking about how the liquor laws came to be and what may be that region's relationship with drinking and places to go, that kind of thing. So it took about 3 years from the concept to printing. But there's no other book out there like this. So we did a lot of talking about what would be the most appealing format and what would be most accessible to people. And most of the codes are available online. Some aren't. They are their law, and then they contradict themselves you know, through amendments to each particular action. So yes, but it's been thoroughly vetted by both fact checker and an attorney. And there was, I read through the law myself, but I had a colleague go through and pick out the more, I guess you might say, salacious aspects of the law. And as far as traveling to the States, I was asked that question recently, so I had to actually go and count. I've been to 28 of them. But that's just through, like I said, making drinking a destination, you know, going to some place to drink beer or for a food festival or to visit distilleries or something like that. It's been an interest and focus of my traveling for many years now.
Well, I can't say that I had any particular desire to go to Nevada before, but now reading in your book that they can serve alcohol 24 hours a day, I might be changing that.
Yeah, well, it's Las Vegas. Yes. You can also go to Atlantic City. That's not too far from you.
Not too far at all. And so a lot of these laws, I mean, from my understanding, most of them or all of them really came from the end of Prohibition. But did in your research, did you find that? Were all of these laws kind of date back to the 1930s, or have they been updated over time? And is there anything that comes from before that time?
From before that time? Well, in a sense, yes. I mean, not to get too dry, but there was an underlying area of temperance and in the northeastern part of the United States, and as the West grew, as the country grew westward, there were sort of these frontier lands where things were particularly lawless, and that's not necessarily good for the home. So the Women's Christian Temperance Movement, among others, women didn't have the vote. So they were an organized group of people trying to get legislation passed to make things a little bit more happier at home. So even though, we have the Women's Christian Temperance Union to blame for a lot of the blue laws, we can thank them because they're in part, organizing women and giving women the right to vote. So they've done a lot more than just prevent us from having a beer. So I'd rather vote than have a beer.
I would say so. But I mean, in terms of the actual legal, the legislation, the laws, were those kind of all written at the end of Prohibition? The ones that we know today, or have there been some significant changes that have happened?
Oh yeah, most of the laws were enacted after Prohibition. There are federal laws that governed the entire area. First, before Prohibition was repealed entirely, there was the small beer legislation that said that you could make these low-point beers. What they did is they sort of didn't actually change the law. They sort of redefined it, and you'll find that in many places, like in Pennsylvania, where you could only buy beer by the case at a beer distributor or by the six-pack at a restaurant. Well, they didn't change the law. They just redefined what a case was. And so too, when Prohibition was repealed, they called these so-called small beers, they called them non-intoxicating, so that they, were no longer able to prohibit it from being sold. But yes, baby steps. And also people that have a vested interest, businesses, those are the kind of people that lobby and get things changed slowly but surely, because once the public has a system in place, it takes a lot to change that system.
And who are those people who have the vested interest? Is it mostly distributors? Is it mostly the public? Is it politicians?
Well, for sure. I would say distributors have, in states where distribution is privately done, they have a huge interest. Mm-hmm. They, not to get too wonky again, but they are responsible for getting things on the shelf. And if you, in some states, like in Oregon, without distributors, you're forced to use a distributor. So if you want your beer on the shelf, you have to go through someone who can get it there. So it's sort of like organized, organized group of a people, but other citizens, people who want to brew beer, people who want to distill spirits, people who have that sort of entrepreneurial spirit, go forward and make these sort of things happen. Yes. But the public, the public does vote on things as a whole, and to use Pennsylvania as an example again, they'll probably come up with some legislation this year as to whether or not their estate stores can be divested. And our neighbor to the north, Washington, they did away with all of their state stores, and the state no longer has any control over any of the alcohol. That, I think, was engineered by Costco. So a big business, a big corporate entity made that law pass. And I think that Washingtonians are sort of regretting it now because the taxes are through the roof, and so a lot of them are coming into Oregon. Anyone on a border is coming into Oregon to buy their alcohol. And Oregon is a control state, meaning all the prices are the same everywhere. So it's an interesting situation. All of it is really interesting.
Wow, that's really fascinating. I mean, I know I have friends down in Philadelphia who will often go to New Jersey to buy their wine and liquor because New Jersey is not a control state and Pennsylvania is, and so the prices are so much better there. And I had assumed that it was always, always in that way, but I guess it's not. I mean, the control states get such a huge amount of revenue from liquor that it seems that what's happened in that case is that they must have just way increased the taxes to make up for the revenue that they weren't getting.
Yes, and it's unfortunate. I think that they skewed it, especially in Washington, a little bit too drastically. But the alcohol sales are up in liquor. I'm talking about sales are up in Washington just because they're just so much more available. You can go to the supermarket and buy it now. So convenience definitely outweighs the hardship of crossing the border for a cheaper price.
So can you talk a little bit about your process and really finding out how alcohol and American values are interwoven? Was when these laws were created, was it a snapshot of general American values, or was it kind of what you're just talking about, that the people who are the most powerful were able, as always, to just to really influence it?
Yes. I think it's religion definitely, predominantly controls especially in the southern states. You know, it's a big country with a diverse belief system, and these organizations that go through and push for legislation or adamantly block anything new that comes in. I think it's a direct reflection of the populace, or rather their acceptance of certain things. States where you can't buy higher point beer readily, easily available. Those states, they're it's just what they're used to, so they continue to do it, and it's not really part of their culture anymore. But not to offend religious groups, I think they're wonderful, and it's a different sort of community that meets at the church versus those that meet at the pub. But they're both important, and I think they do directly reflect the voting populace at the very least.
Okay, and I imagine that's why some of these laws have been able to persist since Prohibition so long ago. From the 1930s to today, if you can imagine the product mix, what things that are different that are available here from all over the world, all this technology, but we still have some of these laws that seem so arcane.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
did you come across anything that was surprising about how alcohol legislation has shaped the beer or wine or spirits industry over time, really what people are producing?
For sure. It's not a lot of... So our book really talks about how the law affects the consumer. But how the law affects the business is... it's a big part of you know, whether those businesses even flourish or not. It, taxes and the startup costs of producing alcohol. Like, you don't find very many breweries in the South or in Florida, for example. But in Oregon, we have more than 100. There are more than 50 in the city limits here. And I think it's because the government makes it sort of easy to start a business up. The same with distilling. You know, distilling is it's a bit federally difficult to be an at-home distiller since it's illegal, whereas most home brewers get their start in their kitchen. The law definitely impacts how a business even comes into place, and so that makes it what's available, you know. And I think and you're in New York, right?
Yes, I'm in Bushwick, Brooklyn, in New York right now.
Great, New York. It's granted huge tax incentives to people who use local products, so who make things locally, out of local ingredients, indigenous ingredients, and certain percentage of them. New York will make the taxes easier on that business, so that makes it much more financially attractive to start a business versus these other sort of big businesses that come in and try and build in a place might have a little bit more difficulty.
Yeah, and it seems that a place like New York, which has a vibrant agriculture, ability to produce not beer and liquor, which could be made pretty much anywhere, but also wine. Obviously, Oregon, where you are, is great for that. There might be some kind of advantage to that, especially. I remember a decade ago, I was working in wine retail, and at the time, the laws were very challenging with shipping state to state. There were these very protective laws,
right.
And that was liberalized. But a state that produces quite a bit and has these very open laws in regards to shipping liquor internally, to giving tax incentives to people who are producing internally. It seems like that would really favor those kind of states.
For sure. You know, New York, before Prohibition, New York had a thriving spirits and beer industry. And then after Prohibition, well, during Prohibition, that acreage was no longer used for the things that you need, the grain that you need to make beer and spirits. And so they sort of lost hop varieties, they lost, and I just recently read an article, I'm sorry I'm blanking on where it was from, but it was talking about how all of these crops are now being grown again to satisfy the people who need to, you know, have a percentage of their product be made from a local ingredient. So it's it helps more than just the distiller. It helps the farmer. It helps the packager, the person who makes the packaging. Mm-hmm. Everything. It's amazing when you start a little spark in an industry that's, you know, considered taboo by some or some regions. It just births this entire range of new businesses and old businesses coming new again, farming, for example, in New York.
Fascinating. All right, we're going to take just a quick break, but we're going to be back with more of Nikki Ganong and her really fascinating book on American laws as it comes, as it pertains to liquor. So we'll be right back.
You're listening to Balloons by Jack Inslee. This is In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Michter's Distillery is a proud sponsor of In the Drink and HeritageRadioNetwork.org. At Michter's, our passion is making the finest whiskeys possible. When you only make small batch and single barrel whiskeys like Michter's does, your whiskey has to be perfect. No detail is too small, from careful attention to the wood used in the construction of our barrels, to lower barrel entry proof before heat cycled aging in advance of exacting chill filtration. and no whiskey gets bottled until Michter's master distiller says it's just right. Michter's cost be damned, taste is everything attitude is apparent in every sip of its smooth, rich whiskeys. Is it worth it? A lot of spirits lovers seem to think so. Food & Wine magazine called Michter's the best American whiskey. Bon Appetit said, it's amazing. And the Wall Street Journal had one special word for Michter's, phenomenal. For more information, visit Michter's.com or simply visit your favorite bartender or retailer and ask for Michter's.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
All right, we're back with Nikki Ganong, the author of the brand new Field Guide to Drinking in America. Nikki, welcome back.
Thanks very much.
All right, let's get into some of the really salacious, fun stuff. What are some of the just absolute wackiest, strangest laws that you came across during your travels and studies?
Well, you know, there are the laws. You can't ride a horse drunk in Colorado, and please don't feed the moose deer in Alaska. There are those sort of books or laws that are on the books that aren't really practical. But the things that I find most interesting are the laws that govern things that affect us, that inconvenience us. Like, for example, California is really a very liberal state to get your drink on in. You know, things are, you know, widely available, and there's a great variety of products in California. But I think they have this growler label legislation that I find bananas, because it just makes it inconvenient for people to use growlers and get a growler refill there. Initially, this and up until just a year ago, California required that you use a growler from the same brewery that you're getting the beer poured into. So can you imagine, you know, you'd have to have like 15 different growlers if you lived in Oregon, because you'd visit all these different breweries that are in your neighborhood and you wanted to get beer to go from them. You'd have to have a special growler. Well, now they've made it so that you can refill any growler, but the label has to have approval. So every single beer that you produce has to have a label that's approved by the state. And also it must cover any other image on the growler itself. So glass growlers that are imprinted with someone else's logo have to be pasted over again and again and again, so you have these paper labels that are attached to building up like a light post, you know.
Wow.
With flyers, yeah. And the thing that's most interesting is that on the label you have to include all this information: the alcohol content, the name of the beer, the brewery. But the one thing that's most important to the consumer, the date when you got this thing filled, isn't required. So it's so ridiculous. Include the date if you're going to make them cover the label up. But you know, it's become such a hassle that breweries just don't do it.
Yeah, it seems like
really
the date would
out,
be
you
the
know?
One important thing. This way, you remember how old it is, how fresh it is, and that seems
right.
Like yeah, that's
a date. Anyway, yeah, there are a lot of laws out there like that that are sort of just ridiculous. But you may not notice them if you live there. If it's your way of activity already.
Yeah, so I can tell throughout this that you're a big fan of growlers. What are the other laws that are consistent throughout that are the issues that drinkers throughout the country are kind of thinking about? Growlers, BYO, closing times.
Yeah, definitely. All that information is in our book, BYOB, whether you can bring something. The closing times, that's an important thing for a consumer. Where you can buy things, where you can't buy things, whether you can take an open bottle of wine home. These are all things that we address on one fact page in the book. And the other part of the book is, you know, an essay about just how things got to be that way. But it's really practical, and it's helpful, and I think it's also interesting as well. You know, we've got all these stories about Prohibition days and things that have survived beyond Prohibition. But the brass tacks, the basic do's and don'ts and cans and can'ts, are all together on one page in the book.
Yeah. And now just for you personally, I know that you've been trained through the beer judge certification program. Can you tell us a little bit about what this entailed and how you first became interested in studying beer? Was it during your research for this book or is it before?
Oh, no, many years before. I moved to Portland maybe 20 years ago, Portland, Oregon, and it's had a thriving beer scene since I came here, and it's been growing over the years. So I guess I became most interested in beer just as a product of, you know, the environment that I live in, the fact that I can just walk past these breweries, and that's really just the culture here. There's a lot of them, and they keep opening up. And so I'm not a home brewer, but I had a very strong interest in beer and the different varieties and styles. And the BJCP, the Beer Judge Certification Program, is sort of like, you know, the Westminster Kennel Club, and how the dog has to be a certain style, so to speak. Like, the dog has to look a certain way in order for it to be, you know, superior, judged superiorly. Well, that's what the BJCP is for beer. We're sort of like the sticklers, how things adhere to a style, not what tastes best, not what's that's part of it too, but it has to taste good, but mostly what style it conforms to. So I've been through those classes and many other seminars as well about beer and about spirits as well, because spirits started in Oregon maybe 10 years ago. Things started booming or growing slowly, and now there's a huge boom on in Portland. There's, I think, maybe 35 now that are in the region. That's a lot. I mean, that's a lot of people to be, you know, producing different spirits, and they're very creative about it, too. So I guess my interest in beer and wine, and wine especially, and the spirits is all just because I live where I live. You know, it's what's here and what we're drinking is always something new. Sizer, have you heard of Sizer? It's sort of like a hybrid of mead and cider, and there's cideries popping up here too. So, that's it, yeah. So that's how I got interested in beer and, you know, traveling all over the world, not just in the United States, and although there are really great breweries all over the United States too, but in Belgium and Germany, and just tasting what other people are making.
Right. Now, I mean, it sounds like Portland is just a super exciting place to be drinking with all those craft brewers, craft distillers, being so close to the Willamette Valley and all the great wine that was there. What are some drinking trends? What are people actually drinking? Are they drinking this cider mead? I mean, what do you
cider
see that people are actually drinking?
Yeah, cider is a huge industry, and it's just booming, in my opinion. But beer is getting bigger, and it will continue to grow. Right now in Portland, and as a matter of fact, opening last night, the craft beer conference brought 12,000 people, 12,000 brewers and people in the industry to the city. So it was with much chagrin that I had to get up at 7 in the morning after last night's opening reception for the craft beer conference. Beer has always been huge, and I think cider is the thing that's booming most, and will continue to grow.
And to tie it back into your book, how have Oregon's particular liquor laws shaped the drinking culture in the food and beverage industry? I mean, I think it's especially interesting and exciting that it's one of the few states that has passed legislation allowing for filling of wine growlers. I didn't even know that anywhere did that.
Yeah, in fact, they were pioneers, the people that put that through, the wine growler legislation. I think they have to come up with a better name for it, but in all of the law, it's all written as growler. It shouldn't be a growler. It should be something more elegant, you know, for the wine industry, I think, than a growler. So the legislation, they can serve beer. That to me is ridiculous. You're outside. It's crazy that you can this gathering of food carts can also have a beer truck. That's really surprising that they allow that. And of course, the filling of growlers, tasting rooms, that every brewery can operate a tasting room.
Great.
Spirits can operate a tasting room. There are places in the United States where that's not the case. That the brewery and the place that serves, or even samples, that have to be two different locations. So the whole brew pub industry is you know, not a factor in those states. But in Oregon, it's huge. The tasting rooms, even if you don't have the license to serve full pours, you can still taste them at many of these places. And they also give up a retail license for many of them, whereas in other states they don't. And it's, you know, distilleries especially, that they can just open is without... I'm not saying that the paperwork is you know, non-existent. There are things, loops that you have to jump through. But, yeah, how it's so available here is why I talk about it so much in the book.
Yeah, and, you know, I'd love to finish on what you see for the future of liquor laws across the country. Do you really anticipate that there'll be any near-term reforms of some really antiquated laws like the blue laws and et cetera?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say what's going on in the country politically. I would like to hope that things get easier or things get more, you know, consumer friendly, but I don't really know. I would hope it does get better, but I would hope there would be no need for our book. I hope we could all just read travel books about what to drink when we're someplace, not how. So I really can't say whether or not it's going to get better or not. Who knows what's going to happen in the next election.
Well, unfortunately, there still is a need for your book to help us decipher the confusing maze that are liquor laws across America. And thank you for creating something that has made that, while still very confusing, a little bit less so.
Well, thanks very much for having me, and thanks for your interest in the Field Guide to Drinking in America.
I think you really did a fantastic job. It's an entertaining book. There's some great tidbits, great stories along with presenting this this information, which can seem like maybe it isn't the most juicy and exciting information. It is when it's presented the way that you do. So congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Also, before we go, I do want to mention that if anyone is around New York City this Saturday, we're going to be doing a beverage class over at Anfora on aperitivi culture in Italy. So we'll have Aperol spritzes and Negronis and Chinar sodas and the like. We'd love to have you there. It's 3:30 to 5 p.m. You can find ticket information on our website, www.anfora.com, and I hope to see you there. All right. Thank you again, Nikki Ganong, author of the Field Guide to Drinking in America. Fantastic book. And thanks to all of you for listening. This has been In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.